This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Welcome to EcoRadio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio and Radio EcoShock. My name is Brent Ragsdale. Today, we're going to talk with two professors from different colleges, universities here in the United States that are working on a group called the Planetary Limits Academic Network, or PLAN. They are Dr. Melody LaHue from Kansas State and Dr. Tom Murphy from University of California, San Diego. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Well, nice to have you. So I understand that you have three other professors that are part of this kickoff for what you're calling the Planetary Limits Academic Network, or PLAN. Tom, I think I'm going to have you just kind of go through and lay out the case why we have planetary limits and what that means to us as humans and what we need to do about it going forward.
It's a big subject, and it's a subject that we're all so embedded into that we can't see the forest for the trees, in a sense. And I like to think of our current epoch, our current era, as being like a fireworks show. It's very exciting. There are a lot of things going on. We're dazzling each other with all the things that we can do. And we've only ever known this mode of existence. We've never even met anybody. Even the oldest person we met when we were a kid only knew this part of the story of human history. So it's understandable that we would have a huge blind spot around how unusual this period in history is. Fireworks shows end. We know that about them. But if you've never seen even the beginning of it, it's always been going on. It's hard to understand that it's something that ends. And what I'm really talking about is that we're spending the inheritance of Earth's ecosystems that we just sort of stumbled onto as we occupied this planet. Not to say that we came from elsewhere, but, you know, as we came into our modern existence on this planet, we had this, you know, tremendous resource base all across the planet. And the story has been, let's exploit that as fast as humanly possible without much consideration to where that goes. And so if you look at what's happening now, we've got forests that are less than half of what was, you know, originally on the planet. Aquifers are being depleted. We've got collapse of fisheries. We've got soil degradation. We've got turning some areas into desert. We're chopping down rainforests. It's pretty global in terms of our impact. And I like relating it to inheritance spending, because we know that that's not a long-term solution, that if you're spending an inheritance very quickly, what happens when it's done? You know, you're going to have to get a job. It's going to get harder. We're kind of heading toward a full Earth scenario. All of our history, all of our narratives, all of our understanding has been developed in a period when we had a frontier, when we had an empty Earth, as it were. And that story is just not the right story for going forward, where we've never had 8 billion people on the planet. We've never seen this level of standard of living that's only increasing and growing in a per capita sense across the world. So the pressures on our ecosystem are tremendous. And I like to think of the ecosystem, you know, a lot of people think, I don't really get outside much and I don't really care. But that's our life support machine. We really cannot survive without a healthy Earth. It's as if we're chewing on the power cord that goes to our life support system. And it tastes good. We love it. It's fun. We're really good at chewing on it. We're proud of what we can do in terms of destruction of this power cord. I'm worried about where this goes. And I don't hear enough discussion about these realities to set my mind at ease.
Yeah, that's a good introduction to your paper and the predicament we're in. And Tom, why don't you introduce yourself?
My name is Tom Murphy. I'm at University of California, San Diego. I've been professor in the physics department for a number of years and mostly focused on astrophysics research. A lot of that time spent testing general relativity by shooting a laser at the moon and measuring to millimeter precision the distance between Earth and moon to understand the shape of the moon's orbit and thus how gravity works is the fundamental question. But I've come to realize that that's not very important stuff compared to the challenges that we're facing in this century.
And I'll say that I have been a fan of your blog that you've written for, I think, a little over 10 years called Do the Math. I've read many of those blog posts and learned a lot from that. And I've also downloaded your new textbook. I know that you've taken a lot of that content from those blog entries from 10 years ago and put this into a really useful text for people to teach sustainable kinds of information. So who are the other three people that are in your network?
So I'll just go ahead and quickly introduce the other members of the, we kind of see ourselves as sort of the core or the leadership team of the network. Ben McCall, his background is in chemistry, and he's also an astrophysicist. And he's currently a professor of sustainability at the University of Dayton, which of course is in Ohio. And then we have Dave Murphy. He's an environmental scientist and is currently at St. Lawrence University, which is located in upstate New York. And then we have Tom Love, who is an anthropologist, and he's an emeriti professor at Linfield University, which is located in Portland, Oregon. And so we all have a very diverse background.
Dave Murphy has done some really good interviews on a podcast called The Energy Transition Show that I have caught and have appreciated as well. And I'll try to put that in our show notes as well. So the five of you went together and wrote an academic paper. And I see that it's in a journal that's called the Energy Research and Social Science Journal. And the name of the paper is Modernity is Incompatible with Planetary Limits, Developing a Plan for the Future.
Radio EcoShock.
Again, you're listening to Eco Radio KC, and my guests today are Professors Melody LeHue and Tom Murphy, and we're talking about the Planetary Limits Academic Network. So, Tom, I think you've given us a pretty good introduction to your paper. I'll say that you have not many pictures and graphs in your paper, but you do include one that this is radio, so we have to describe it. It kind of looks like just a little blip. It's a graph of energy consumption for humanity, that what we have done in the last 1,000 years and maybe what we're going to do in the next 1,000 years. And there's a big blip around the year 2000.
If we look at how much energy humans have spent over the course of history, it started out being very, very small. The population was low. It was just muscle and firewood. It was animals on drafting, draft animals pulling plows, human labor, and firewood. That's where our energy came from. And then we discovered fossil fuels and started using them in this prodigious manner so that the energy graph shoots up. It's one of these hockey stick curves. It just goes bananas. About 150 years ago, it just rockets upward. As I said before, that's the fireworks show. That's what we've all known. That's our entire life history and that of our grandparents. What we recognize, though, is that the fossil fuels, in any case, are finite. They're not going to last forever. We're roughly maybe halfway through or a third of the way through. It's debatable. You can get different numbers. But it doesn't change the story that we're a significant fraction of the way through and that the fossil fuel curve, if we were to continue plotting this, goes right back towards zero for the next thousands of years. When you look at this plot of energy use over thousands of years, at least in the context of fossil fuels, it is, as you say, a blip. It's just a spike, a pulse. I've heard it called the carbon pulse. It invites a huge question as to what comes for the next few thousand years. Are we back to a primitive lifestyle? Because that's what we know happens in a low energy or did happen in a low energy situation before. So it really begs that uncomfortable question. There's a symmetry to this curve that it's low, it peaks, we're up near the high point right now, and then it goes back low. So what does that mean for the future? It doesn't put us on the definite path toward a primitive future. We could, in principle, use other, renewable energy resources like solar and wind to maintain some decent level that's not down at zero. But it's a graph that at least makes you really think about the fact that our future is not guaranteed to look like the present. In fact, it's very unlikely to. I would say it can't.
Another point that you made before the break was about how technology is only going to go so far, and there's a tendency to believe in progress, kind of like a secular religion of sorts for modern people. I think there's certainly a camp of people that think that the solution is going to become for us to become a multiplanetary species. And since the two of you are astrophysicists, you included a little bit of talk about how difficult and actually unrealistic that is. You want to walk us through your chickpea star scale kind of analogy there to show how difficult that would be?
Yeah, and the reason we do this is because I think most people form their impression of space through entertainment. And watching shows, you can zip around from one planet to the next nebula to, you know, whatever. And it's all very convenient. It's just like a short bus ride. And it's so different from that. It's also, in these movies, resources are never far away. A planetary surface or a spaceship or a station, never very far away. But the reality is that it's almost mind-bogglingly empty. If a star is the size of a grain of sand, in our local environment, those grains of sand are 20 miles apart. So they are not close. There's a lot of emptiness in between. And a solar system on that scale would be the size of a bedroom. So you've got your grain of sand in the middle of the bedroom shining luminously, and specks of dust, like maybe 10, you know, specks of dust somewhere in the bedroom. It's a lot of empty space. In terms of resources, people talk about mining asteroids and getting resources from space. Well, first of all, Earth is a big chunk of resource that we're sitting right on that we don't have to spend a lot of energy to get to. But if this were an economically viable strategy, we'd be all over it already. It's not that we don't have the technology to do this kind of thing. It's just infeasible. It's just prohibitively expensive in terms of energy and cost. So, you know, I like to think of a nickel. A U.S. nickel is a nice little chunk of nickel, and it's about worth 5 cents. It's worth about 5 cents. So if you were to get that chunk of nickel from an asteroid, you can expect to pay, you know, maybe a few thousand dollars or something. I'm making up the number, but I'm just illustrating that it didn't take Earth for granted.
That's our real treasure, as you call it in your paper. It's the real treasure. Let's talk about growth. That seems to be like the next section in your paper, that people seem to be programmed to want growth, and that our whole society is set up on supplying people with the goods and services, the increase in goods and services that they seem to want. Can that go on? Can that keep going at the rate it's going?
So obviously not. It's, as I say, the finite planet and the inheritance spending mode. So, you know, what you can afford to do during the inheritance spending mode is completely different from what you can afford to do long term. As I said, the pressures on our system, the rate at which we're extracting resources from the Earth have never been as high as they are today. And it's starting to take its toll. We can see it in many domains. And that can't go on very long. And anything that's a constant growth behaves like an exponential. And even at a few percent per year, that amounts to a factor of 10 every century. So we're having trouble keeping it together at today's rate. You see all kinds of failures in all kinds of systems. So can you imagine a century from now having things be 10 times bigger than they are today in terms of scale of extraction? It's hard to imagine even maintaining this level for another century. We're already running into all kinds of feedbacks from Earth saying, no, I can't take it any longer. And the idea that we would just keep expanding the scale as we have for the past several generations is really on its face kind of ridiculous.
The idea that we should keep training up engineers to make more products and architects to design bigger and bigger houses and ag economists to develop more and more feed for more and more cattle for more and more people. We can't keep doing this. We've got to figure out a way to curb that growth.
I'd say either we do it or nature will do it for us. I would rather be in control of that situation and do it wisely and justly, because if we don't take control of that situation or at least acknowledge the perils that we're putting ourselves in, we can't be sure that it's going to be a pleasant ride down.
You have put out this paper and have it on a website. Can you give the website where people could find this academic paper?
It's Planetary Limits, all one big amalgamation, no punctuation or anything, just planetarylimits.net.
Have you had any success in recruiting other academics? Have you been contacted?
It's been quite amazing, at least from my perspective. As soon as the paper was published, we started getting people interested in joining. And I believe we have about 60 members so far. And they are from a range of different disciplines. When someone indicates that they're interested in being a member, we have like a series of questions and information that we ask them to, you know, give us some sort of response to, so we can understand where they're coming from and what their concerns are. What's, I think, really compelling is that you have all of these people from very different disciplines, but we all are basically concerned about the same things. In some ways, that kind of validates that, yes, this is something that we need to address, because it's not just a few of us that are like, oh my goodness, we need to figure out how are we going to move forward as a society where we can have quality of life, but at the same time not consume resources to the degree that we have been consuming them. You have all of these different disciplines, people from all these different disciplines that are concerned about the same thing. We're right now just kind of growing the membership, and then we're going to start thinking about, okay, now what's our first step? What are we going to do in order to try to address and do some actionable research that might result in some, if not solutions, but at least a clearer understanding of what we need to tackle first.
And I would like to add that the five of us who started this recognize that we don't have the answers. We don't have enough perspective. We're not broad enough that even though the five of us are from fairly different areas, that's a great start to the network, but we really need economists and humanists and psychologists and people in communications, and it really is everything. So we haven't really set out a firm plan yet, even though our network name is Plan, because we wanted to gather those folks first to help us define what we collectively want to do. The other thing I'll say is that, as Melody mentioned, we share a lot of similar concerns, and I just want to address the fact that all of us are concerned about climate change, but we tend to see much deeper than that. That's just one element, one symptom of much more intricate underlying disease. It's kind of the tip of the iceberg. It's what everybody sees in plain sight, and it focuses so much attention of the academic world onto climate change, but we think, oh my gosh, you know, yes, that's important, but if you don't solve the systemic problems of growth and resource exploitation and inheritance spending, et cetera, we're still going to fail in our energy systems. We're still going to fail. So my view is, even if climate change miraculously weren't an issue, like, for instance, carbon dioxide didn't interact with infrared radiation, and so there was no, you know, climate cost to burning fossil fuels, I wouldn't be much less worried about our predicament this century, just because all of the toll on Earth's ecosystem is just staggering. We have species loss even without climate change. We have habitat destruction. And so I think we're all climate change aware, but our concerns run deeper.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. We're talking about the Planetary Limits Academic Network. Tom Murphy, you just gave us a good segue into the fact that the other academics that are showing interest in your network seem to recognize that our problems are greater than just climate change. Climate change is one facet of an overarching problem. I noticed in your paper that you have your preliminary set of foundational principles. Can you go through those for us?
We decided against in the paper to frame this as we originally had, as kind of principles that we find to be self-evident. We had some parallels to kind of the beginnings of the United States and some of its declarations. But these are, in some sense, truths that we do find to be self-evident, and we laid them out just to make sure that the people who we wanted to attract were basically on the same page and had no major disagreements. And so this list, number one, is humans are a part of nature, not apart from nature. Number two, non-renewable materials cannot be harvested indefinitely on a finite planet. Number three, the ability of Earth's ecosystems to assimilate pollution without consequences is finite. Number four, energy throughput is essential to all human activities, including the economy. Number five, technology is a tool for deploying, not creating energy. Number six, fossil fuel combustion is the primary cause of ongoing global climate change. Number seven, exponential growth, whether of physical or economic form, must eventually cease. Number eight, today's choices can simultaneously create problems for and deprive resources from future generations. Number nine, human behavior is consciously and unconsciously shaped by mental models of culture that, while mutable, impose barriers to change. And number 10, apparent success for a few generations during a massive drawdown of finite resources says little about chances for long-term success.
You didn't talk much in your paper about potential pushback, but I would think that there's a tendency for people to deny things that they don't want to think about. That seems to be human nature. And then there's also the potential for people to feel threatened in terms of their livelihood or their profession or what they stand for. One thing that I highlighted in your paper, entrenched institutions will resist change and their leaders will argue departure from the present trajectory will threaten prosperity and happiness. Are you seeing any of that reaction so far?
I have not had anyone comment to me and give any kind of pushback as of yet. I understand why people want to deny and why they might want to disagree. But, you know, the scientific evidence is there that these changes are happening. Our ecosystems are being threatened.
Well, I think it's absolutely right that we've got a lot of financial and power interests that like the way things are. Even if you're not enjoying that kind of prosperity today, you have made maybe life plans based on this set of rules and the way we run things today. And you don't want the rules to suddenly change because maybe your plans don't make much sense then. And so it makes a lot of sense to me that any massive change is going to see a lot of resistance. And I think the point that I want to make is we're not advocating for some voluntary massive change just because we have certain values or ideals. It's really something that we can't control. It's something that nature is going to do for us if we don't do it ourselves. We don't see it as much as a choice, except in that we have a choice of how we interact with this impending crisis, and we'd like to be smart about it and like to acknowledge the dangers and not just pretend that they're not there.
The one group that would really like this would be the students, would be the young people who have grown up in this environment and realizing that we're up against planetary limits and seeing a lot of inaction in terms of solutions from the people, the vested interests. I would think they're just hungry to hear some reality and some ideas towards mitigating the problems and making things better going forward. Is that the way it is?
Today's generation, they all know that there's a problem. And so they come to us knowing this, but they haven't quite made the link that their own behavior is a major contributor to the problem. We try to help them understand how their decisions and their behaviors are part of the problem. We are preparing these young people to go out and work in an industry that has a huge impact on the environment, not just climate change, but water pollution and waste and, you know, every aspect of the degradation of our planet. Our industry, the fashion, the textile and apparel industry, is a major contributor. And so we are preparing these young people to be aware of the problem and to start seeking ways to do things differently. So when they are out there in the industry, they can be agents of change instead of just falling into the status quo. The young generation, they want to make a difference. And so they are very receptive, I find.
Yeah, and if I might echo some of that in what I see, I no longer have to make a hard case to the students that growth is going to end. They already get that, and that's a big improvement. But I am also disappointed, similar to what Melody said, they don't really necessarily understand how their own actions and expectations play into this. So I've seen a lot of angst against, for instance, billionaires, but they're ordering stuff on Amazon all the time. It's sort of ironic that if you were to take all the money that the billionaires have and redistribute it to the broader population, you would only see an increase in energy demand and resource exploitation because people would want to spend that money on stuff. And that's where the problem is. It's our stuff. And I've had students, basically, they get that there's a problem, they want to see big change, but they point the finger somewhere else. There are plenty of places to point fingers. I mean, they're not wrong to point out some of the problems, but they don't want to modify their own behaviors. They don't want to take fewer, shorter showers or anything, or turn down their thermostat or change their dietary habits, because that's very personal, and they feel like they deserve all of those comforts, and it's the billionaires and so forth that need to do the paying, not them.
So again, the website for any academics or others who are interested is planetarylimits.net. My name is Brent Ragsdale. Thank you very much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Yes, right. Thank you for inviting us.
That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.